You never use the laser. After all that, I got a laser and nobody ever wants to use it. So our next guest came all the way up from Boulder today. I'm really grateful to have him. I first became aware of Kyle through a podcast that he hosts called the Bike Nerds Podcast, which he's had a couple of folks that I know from other EDs from other advocacy groups in town. And they do, has anybody listened? Are you guys, anybody Bike Nerds fans? It's a really great podcast. If you haven't, I really recommend checking it out. But he talks to people that are kind of making the news in national bike advocacy. He also, in addition to hosting the podcast as his day job on the side, is the, help me with the title, director of local innovation for People for Bikes, which is another cool thing I think that we're going to want to talk to about because they've got some cool program coming up. So I just want to bring up Kyle Wagenschutz. Come on up.
Thanks.
So this is cool. So like, it's oh, you know what? I don't want to have Tessa on here anymore. So this is actually a picture of Kyle and his co-host. Do you want to tell us tell us how Bike Nerds Podcast came about and what it is? And
yeah, so it's an interesting story. My co-host and I, Sarah, were on a trip together last fall in Amsterdam. We were there doing a bike study tour with a bunch of other people from the city of Memphis, which is where Sarah lives, and it's where I just moved here from. And we were sitting at a cafe, having some coffee and maybe some drinks late at night. And I told her that I had this desire to like have a podcast, but I needed her help like whittling down like the kind of podcast, because I'm really interested like in three major things: bikes, soccer, and Star Wars. Like those are the things. Like if you guys want to ask me questions tonight about soccer or Star Wars, I can also field all of those questions. But I told her that that was not a good like podcast like theme, right? Like bikes, soccer, and Star Wars. There would be like three people listening. Nobody would get it. And somehow, shape or another, Sarah decided at one point that she was going to be the producer of this podcast, and she was going to help me narrow the focus down. And then eventually she just became the co-host of the podcast. And really what it came down to is Sarah and I are both huge podcast fans. We listen to podcasts all day long. But there wasn't a podcast that was really talking about people that were changing communities using bikes across the country. And so, and we know tons of those people. They're doing awesome things. We hear about it, you know, annually or biannually at conferences that happen across the U.S., but very few people are sort of being exposed to all of that kind of stuff. So honestly, it's sort of a podcast that we hope is just sort of exploring what other communities are doing, talking to people that are doing really cool things, and, you know, trying to weasel in Star Wars wherever I can along the way.
So I mentioned also it's interesting interviewing somebody that interviews people a lot. So I'm kind of trying to figure out the angle on this. So I want to jump to the People for Bikes thing too. So you moved here because of the People for Bikes opportunity. So now you're in Boulder.
Yeah.
And tell me about what it means to be the director of local innovation for People for Bikes. So what's
that? That's a great question, because
I think that's kind of relevant to the room here.
It's a brand new position. So let me just back up and say, so in Memphis, I spent 5 years working for a local community bicycle co-op, which then turned into Memphis's local bike advocacy group. A couple years into that, I was hired by the city of Memphis to lead the city's official bicycle program, hired by the mayor's office. So I spent 6 years working for the city of Memphis, doing a whole host of things. And then the opportunity came up to sort of, you know, apply for and join the team at People for Bikes. And so I've done this real like broad gambit of bicycle related things, right? From working on bikes as a bike mechanic in a community bike shop, to leading local advocacy, to running an official citywide program, now back in advocacy, but at the national level. And this position is really allowing me to continue to work in cities across the US and help them do better for people in their communities. So a lot of the work that I'm doing is helping cities and helping communities look at their programs, helping them sort of, you know, better align strategies, better align facilities through storytelling, talking about great examples in other cities, trying to tease out common threads from communities across the U.S. You know, an interesting thing is that every community in the U.S. is a unique community, right? If you travel, if Tessa was to go to another community and talk about what Fort Collins is doing, the first thing she would hear is, well, you know, what we do here is a little bit different. It can't be applied. That's the same no matter what community you go to. You always hear about how unique another community is. But the truth of the matter is that there are common threads that exist throughout all of those. And so what People for Bikes do and what the local innovation department does is try to tease those out, make them replicable on a much bigger level, and sort of broaden the scope and impacts that we have. So I'm leading a new program called the Big Jump Project at People for Bikes. It's going to be a 3-year initiative working in 10 different communities across the U.S. with a goal of doubling or tripling bike use in that community in 3 years. I'm proud to say, you know, Fort Collins made an application, so they're in the running to maybe be one of those 10 communities. But it's really about recognizing that communities are doing awesome things already, right? If you go to any community in the U.S., you can almost find like a really great trail or a really great bicycling group or a really great, you know, weekly ride that's happening. Like, cities are doing good things already for biking, but few cities are sort of piecing together all of those individual efforts in a way that really sort of gets big results in a very short time period. And the thing with the Big Jump is about recognizing what cities are doing and helping them sort of align those stars in a much better way so they can get the results that they actually want to receive. And a big piece of that is with the Big Jump is talking about networks. And so it was really great to sort of already hear sort of that kind of conversation happening, you know, here in Fort Collins. And there's two sort of sides of the network coin. One is the physical infrastructure. Does the infrastructure that you're riding on, is it safe and comfortable for you to ride on? Is it safe and comfortable for your kids and your grandparents to also ride on? And does it get you to the places that you want to go? You know, we have in the U.S. in many communities really great trail networks, right, that are super comfortable to ride on. They're beautiful. There's gorgeous scenery. But how many of them actually get you to, like, the grocery store? How many of them actually get you to school in the morning? You know, we haven't really thought about how we take these really great, safe facilities and connect people to the places that they're actually trying to get to. That's the opposite if you think about sort of car networks, right? Car networks will get you to the front door of the place that you actually want to go to. And it's super easy, it's super convenient to do so. And if what we've been doing at People for Bikes lately is we've been taking maps of cities and looking at the street networks. And then you take out everything that's not, take out everything that's a car network. And so all you're left with is the bike network on the screen. And it just looks like my 4-year-old son was like just drawing lines, right? And then you put on there like the schools and where people are living. You're like, well, how do you get to this school? All the lines are over there. How would you actually get there by bicycle? And so there's this whole piece about, you know, sort of bringing together. We know how to design great bike facilities. We know how to build trails, protected bike lanes, you know, neighborhood greenways, but bringing that all together in a way that actually makes sense for people using it. The flip side to the network conversation is also this notion about networks of people and how people are actually interacting with bicycling, how bicycles are interacting with communities. And so, you know, a big focus that I have and a big, you know, sort of level of expertise that I sort of bring from the Memphis side is how to organize community members in a way that builds community support for bicycle infrastructure, particularly in neighborhoods not traditionally thought of as bicycle advocates. And so in Memphis, you know, we work with many times 95%, you know, neighborhoods where the populations are 95% African American. The median incomes in those neighborhoods are 30% below national averages, and bicycling is not the top priority for those neighborhoods. But we've been able to, you know, use a lot of sort of community organizing tactics, strategies, relationship building to sort of build up bases of bike advocacy in these neighborhoods that aren't traditionally thought of as, you know, hotbeds for cycling.
Yeah. So what is the? I think, you know, we pride ourselves, I think, on being a bike a platinum bike friendly community, and we're one of five in the country that's at that level. And even at that level, we look at mode share in the like high single digits, you know, 7-8 if we're lucky. What do you think, in your perception, are the barriers that People for Bikes or that your work can bring to, can help, how can you help overcome the barriers to making those numbers look more like the numbers we see in Europe or like people that take it really seriously?
So there used to be this thought in bike advocacy that if you build it, they will come, right? That what was really holding back U.S. cities from achieving European level bike mode share, you know, 30-40% in some parts of Western Europe, was the fact that we didn't have European infrastructure on the ground. And to a certain extent, that's true. You know, you have to be able to provide comfortable places for people to ride that's intuitive to use, you know, that you have sort of built into the entire culture around, you know, transportation and mobility, that bicycling is sort of an integral part of that. And infrastructure certainly plays a part in that. But if you look at U.S. cities that have invested lots of money and rapidly built out bike networks, you will see a correlation in sort of the increase in bike use, but there's always a plateau. There's always a point at which new infrastructure isn't actually generating new riders. That's true in Memphis when I was there between 2010 and this last spring, saw like a 500% increase in bicycling riding over those four or 5 years. Not difficult to sort of ascertain, you know, that a city that had almost no bike infrastructure built some, you know, a couple hundred miles in a couple of years and saw some increase in riding. But that number plateaued off.
Still feels marginal, I think.
Very marginal. Yeah. So what we're saying now is that it's not if you build it, they will come. It's if you build the right thing in the right place and promote it well, then they will come. So there's this whole other piece that goes back to this network piece, right? It's not just about building infrastructure. It's about connecting people to that infrastructure, making sure that the infrastructure actually meets the needs that they actually have. You know, again, can I get to the grocery store? Can I get to church? Or can I get to, can my children get to school? And understanding and reacting to the kinds of situations that people experience every day in a way that makes it more attractive for them to use that in the long run.
So coming from Memphis, where it sounds like you guys were doing really great work, to Boulder, which I think reputationally is a pretty advanced place. What are some observations that you have about what jumped out at you culturally, culture shock, about the difference between positive and negative? Like what jumps out at you about the differences between the work you're doing there and here?
So I use the word y'all a lot, and they don't use that here in Boulder or in Colorado.
You just got to go east. You'll be fine. Just
I think it's a great pronoun.
2 miles east, right over there.
It's a different discussion about the use of the word y'all. Also, I use a lot more biblical metaphors. It's if you live in the South, you have to sort of learn to sort of provide analogies that relate to Bible verses. So I'm pretty good at that as well. So no, but I would say, you know, the biggest thing that I've noticed is that I'm super defensive when I'm riding my bicycle, you know, to and from work every day. I definitely stop at stop signs, you know, for instance. I feel like the people who are driving in Colorado have a greater awareness of what, you know, bicyclists are doing. And my experience is limited to Boulder because I've only been here for 2 months and I've basically just been working for all 2 months of that. Haven't done too much exploring, but yeah, I was sort of shocked on the morning rush hour bike commute, you know, when I was like pulling up to a stop sign and I would stop in, you know, the number of people on bikes who were just passing me going through there. Also sort of like in Boulder, they have like these mid-block crossings where like people hit the button, the lights go off and people just start crossing the street. And there's like an interesting like notion. They literally just push the button and they don't look to see if the cars have actually stopped. They just go. And I'm just like, guys, what are you doing? So, you know,
leave a faith.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I would think that's pretty true. There's definitely,
do you think that's a good thing? Do you think those are positive things ultimately? Is that matter?
I would say yes and no. I mean, if you look at Amsterdam, maybe, you know, one of the cities with one of the highest bike mode shares and definitely above 40%, there is a level of, I've never felt more like in danger in my life while riding a bicycle than when I've been riding in Amsterdam. And it's not because of the cars, it's because of all the other people on bicycles there, right? And so there's a to a certain degree, some of that sort of sense of danger can be good, you know, in terms of raising your awareness, yeah, and being alert of what's there. You know, to another certain degree, a place like, you know, Boulder, who has lots of out of town people, lots of visitors coming there. You know, my parents were here, And I was like, Dad, you've got to like watch, because these people will not stop when they cross the street. You just have to be really careful. It could be, you know, the flip side of that could be that you have lots of tourists coming because it's a really cool place and they don't quite understand, you know, all the sort of idiosyncrasies of that kind of culture.
So for you guys, when he got in this afternoon, we went for a ride, and I thought that what I'd show him was we went down Mason from here, essentially, so it went across mountain over to Mason, showed him the Mason corridor all the way through campus down to the Trial Garden underpass, and then come back on Remington to show him the Remington Greenway, and then we just went out on the Poudre Trail all the way up to La Porte and back. So based on, I mean, it wasn't a huge, it wasn't everything. Did you have any thoughts or impressions, or what did Fort Collins feel like as a place to ride to you, just based on that, on the spot, putting you on the spot?
Yeah, I mean, we were out for like an hour.
Yeah, something like
that. I pretty much got the whole lay of the land. I felt it was great. I mean, there was, I definitely, you know, sort of really enjoyed you showing me a lot of the new infrastructure pieces that were going in. The low stress street, tell me the street that we were on.
Remington,
I thought that was great. Particularly as it approached like the roundabout, and you know, the navigation signs were great because you weren't doing like a great job of telling me where we were going.
The navigation signs. Keeping him on his toes.
It was like the one point in the trip where I was like, all right, we're going that way, because that's where the arrow is pointing. You know, the trail, tell me again the name of the trail.
We were on the Poudre Trail.
Poudre Trail. Yeah, I thought it was, you know, beautiful, recreational, great. You know, I think it demonstrates a lot of, you know, what I was sort of saying that we're focused on the big jump is that cities are doing the right things. But the way that cities work is not bureaucracy is not set up to work fast in any way, shape, or form. It's a very incremental process. In every single city. And there's not a lot that can be done to sort of change that. Many of those kinds of things exist because of rules about fairness and things that have to do with sort of government accountability. And some of that just lends itself to being sort of a lengthy process. I think the innovation that's happening sort of across the U.S. is understanding that there are processes that are sort of stuck in the same way they've been done for 50 years, and they're unlikely to change. But there are interim things that can be done to, one, make it seem like progress is happening a lot faster, to, two, actually make progress happen a lot faster, and to provide lots of results sort of in between. So as you sort of wait for these long, lengthy bureaucratic processes to take place, you can actually get some action in between. And cities are sort of learning to do that more as they're thinking more about reacting to citizens' needs rather than, you know, planning for them 10 years down the road.
So I think this is a place where maybe your Bike Nerd podcast and the People for Bikes Work interact. Is what in your conversations with city planners and transportation planners and bike advocates around the country, what are their common themes that are emerging as the best practices that you're seeing? Anybody identifying priorities or best practices, or are you observing things from a position of being kind of a national level engager of local leaders that you're going, oh, this is the thing that we're all struggling with, and this is the way we're kind of trying to move past it?
Yeah, you know, I think a hot topic recently has been sort of this tactical urbanism / quick build. You know, how do cities do things faster? And People for Bikes just this last spring released a report about quick build, which is this idea, again, that, you know, taking a transportation project, particularly if it has federal or state grant funding tied to it, you know, the average length for that project could be 8 to 10 years. And so by the time that you engage people in a planning process and actually build a project 8 years later, all of those people are like gone or dead. The people that are there 8 years later are totally pissed off that you just built this thing and you didn't ask them about it, even though they weren't there at the beginning of the process. And cities are stuck in this loop because that's how funding sort of happens in cities. They would do it faster if they could, but there's a lot of reasons why they can't. And so what we were finding was that some cities, and I'm proud to say Memphis was sort of one of these cities that's featured in the report, they were saying, okay, well, it's going to take us 8 years to build out this street reconstruction project where we're going to have really great curb-separated protected bicycle lanes and street trees, and our buses are going to be great on it. We're going to sort of fix the sidewalks. It's going to take us 8 years to do that. But is what can we do now to sort of seed some of that change? Well, we can use paint, right, to sort of paint this stuff out. We could redesign this curb with paint, some white posts, some planters, and make it seem like there's a curb there without actually building a curb. And cities were like, oh, well, I mean, yeah, we have paint laying around, and we have all this other like junk that we just store at warehouses throughout our cities. Yeah, we could probably do that. And so cities were beginning to sort of experiment with this. New York City was probably the first one to sort of do it like at a big scale, but other communities were also doing that. And so what happens is you get to have your planning meeting a year later, you get to paint your sort of redesign, maybe not fully realized, but in an interim step. People get to begin using this new configuration. You get tons of feedback about, is it working? Is it not working? What needs to be tweaked? Are there safety concerns from this? Is it a huge success? By the time that you get down to this 8-year process, you've vetted this project in a way that's never been vetted before, right? You've tested it in the real world before you've actually built it. There's nothing worse from a city's perspective of spending like $10 million on a project, getting done with it, having the ribbon cutting, and finding out that you designed something wrong, right? Because it looks terrible in the newspaper. The media is all over you for being a bunch of, you know, idiots who can't get anything right. But this new quick build process is allowing the cities to sort of both bridge the gap from a public engagement perspective, but also from a design and engineering perspective, really sort of test their designs out. And so cities are beginning to sort of do that. A lot of it has to do with public input. So I think cities are also redefining the ways in which people provide input that deal with funding, design, you know, strategic long-term priorities for cities. There's a lot of, you know, like sort of open budgeting. There's a lot of community-driven budgeting happening across the country now. And departments within cities that are doing really great jobs of getting community members involved in decision-making, I think are probably the communities that are sort of making the biggest headlines today.
Awesome. So take our polls and come to our advocacy teams and stuff. So be involved. So anybody have anything while we have Kyle up here? Any questions for Kyle? Anything? We got him up here, guys. He came up from Boulder. Any questions?
Drove from Boulder.
Drove all the way up from Boulder. Yeah.
Hold on 1 second. We got one down here. If you want to start listening to the podcast, should we start listening going forward, or should we go back and listen to
It's a great question. So we're like, I think 25 episodes in at this point. You know, you could probably like skip maybe like the first 4 or 5. I feel like we were like trying to like get our legs underneath of us. The first like 4 or 5 are like Memphis people. We were sort of testing things out with our friends. I would say that the more recent podcasts have been really great in terms of content. Our goal is to sort of just ask questions of people and then let them talk for as long as they want to talk. So some people will talk the whole podcast. We have one coming out. It releases tonight at midnight, so you can get it tomorrow. But this guest, we simply like asked like 3 questions for the whole hour, and he just filled in all of the middle ground himself. And those are great. Other guests require more prompting. There's also, in addition to sort of interviewing people, we have some segments where we have sort of just topical areas, and we have a panel of people who will sort of provide feedback on some of that. And then there's some episodes of just Sarah and I just goofing off and you know, sort of catching up with each other. Since we're not in the same city anymore, that requires you know, a conscientious effort to sort of stay in touch with what's going on with each other. Yeah.
All right. So I know you mentioned, you kind of briefly touched on this, but just mentioning how like there's a lot of barriers within the city with things getting done, with the processes and things taking, you know, slower than usual. Yeah. What do you think are some of the social barriers that, you know, get people out on bikes, so to speak?
You know, some of those are a bit harder to classify sort of on a broad scale, because so much of what happens in communities is very local and has to do sort of with the identity of those kinds of communities. So, you know, I mentioned some of my work in Memphis was done in South Memphis, which is where like the Stax Records Museum is located, Aretha Franklin's birthplace home, a ton of Isaac Hayes lived there for a while he was recording records. You know, it sort of has this very strong musical and cultural identity around its heritage, dealing with sort of soul music in the 1970s. It's mostly a neighborhood today that's mostly made up of senior citizens on one end of the spectrum and super young families with lots of elementary school age children on the other spectrum, almost no sort of middle ground in terms of age. And bicycling there is not like top of the priority for anybody there. What is top of the priority though is traffic safety. And when I was working in South Memphis with the local church there, you know, we led this 2-year planning process with the neighborhood to have sort of the residents of the neighborhood help to design a new strategic vision for the neighborhood that the city would approve and begin investing money in. And, you know, one of the reasons I was there is because I was a grad student at the time, but I wasn't there sort of wearing my bike hat. I was there like knocking on doors, inviting people to public meetings, trying to conduct public meetings in a way that felt like we were actually getting information from the residents. And lo and behold, at the end of the 2-year process, there were bike projects in this neighborhood plan. Definitely not prompted by me, but it came out of the desires of the neighborhood. And the residents were not approaching this from a thinking about riding their bikes for fun. They weren't thinking about, you know, how would it help me get to someplace. There was like a real need to slow down truck traffic on this one particular roadway. And there was a law in Memphis that if a bicycle lane was on a roadway, the trucks couldn't use it during certain hours of the day, and the speed limit had to be reduced to a certain point. And so residents were advocating for bicycle facilities in their neighborhood because they had this totally other separate agenda item. And you know what happened? We saw that this bike lane project was in the neighborhood, so when I got hired by the city, we built the bicycle lanes, and now there's bicycle lanes running through this neighborhood. And now there's also a farmer's market right along the bicycle lane. This neighborhood doesn't have a grocery store. All the farmers were sort of selling produce out of their trucks on the side of the road. When we added the bicycle lanes, they could no longer park on this road to sell their produce. So the church bought a vacant gas station across the street, set up a official farmer's market that's there 7 days a week, and now people are riding their bikes to the farmer's market to buy their produce. You know, and there's a senior center right down the street who said, hey, we're having trouble walking from the senior center that we're at every single day to the farmer's market, but there's this abandoned rail corridor that leads right behind all of it. Could we build a trail to it? And so, you know, we begin thinking about sort of the social implications of what neighborhoods need around bicycling. And it's one of those things that is best left to the local people that are actually there and understanding what their needs are. There's this, I've heard somebody say recently that it's not about what bikes can do for communities, it's about what communities can do with bikes. And I think that's a really powerful sort of thing in thinking about, you know, how we approach sort of bike advocacy from a sort of a non-traditional way, right? Instead of touting the benefits of what bikes can actually do, you know, understanding in what ways bikes can serve as a tool in our communities to address other areas.
That's awesome. So we got to wrap up and go to the next segment. So thank you so much to Kyle Wagonshoots for coming up. And check out the Bike Nerds podcast and stay tuned to see what happens with the jump.